Where have we been? Just a quick survey. Go back to Elijah and Salome, where the snake wraps itself around Jung. And I felt that had to do with his accepting the erotic problem and transforming through it. Then, and he then, remember he got this in the lion's head. And I felt that was really a representative of his long-term point of view, which he wrote most succinctly in Ion. And the link is that Ion is a lion-headed god. So that introduced the issue, the underlying issue. And then we had the red one, which I felt was a personification. This is, of course, my interpretation. But, so take it or leave it. Was a personification of the, you could say of what the snake represented. It's the passion, the eros, the sexuality. And then he comes to the castle in the forest where he sees the young girl and the old scholar. It's the same problem again. The young girl would be like Salome or like the red one, that same, embodying that same energy. And the old scholar would be like Elijah. It would be wisdom, but wisdom that is at that point separated from eros, like in the head, you might say, in pop language. The problem returned again in the chapter One of the Lowly, where that guy was kind of a bum. And the point, again, and as I got it, was we're seeing a line of development. He is the eros, sexuality, low impulses that Jung is wrestling with. And where before we had, say, in Elijah and Salome, we had the two together. Now we're getting first the Salome side in the and the Red Knight side in the One of the Lowly, and then the next chapter it swings to the other side, the Anchorite, which was the spiritual side. So first he goes to the instinct, and he goes to spirit. And you know, I'm about two pages ahead of you. I've read the whole thing, but I certainly didn't digest it in one reading. And I think where we're going soon is we're going to see these two united. But before we get to the union, there's going to be a death. And that's what we're that's what we'll soon be dealing with.
I get the feeling that he's traveling through these images, taking the essential aspects he needs from each one, and he's bringing it with him, and then on he goes.
And then he'll unite them in a singular attitude toward the psyche. Which involves the mind and the heart working together. And if you ever listen to academics, you can just see how those two are absolutely split. They nitpick, they make distinctions where there isn't any. Logically, maybe you can make a distinction, but when the heart is involved, there's no conflict. And then I believe we're going to see the two transformed into a unitary point of view down the road. So we're swinging, and then we're going to see a death, and then we're going to see a rebirth as a unified whole coming down the road next couple of weeks. So we go to Dies, I think it's pronounced, 2. Page 270. Remember in the last chapter he's dealing with the sun. And that continues in Dies 2. Which means the second day. Dies must be Latin, I guess. Dies irae is the Mass of the Dead, I think, right? Meaning the day of wrath. Nice way to end life. He was fascinated by the sun in the last section, and he's going to continue being fascinated with the sun now. What I made of that is he has not yet distinguished between consciousness and spirit. Both are masculine. And remember, we've talked about it here, you may or may not remember, that the word for spirit in German originally meant mind and what we call spirit, as in the Holy Spirit. You say in German Geist. Geist can mean ghost. It can mean spirit, like he's a geistliche Person, he's a spiritual person. Or Geist can mean mind. He has a geistliche Störung, which would be a mental disturbance. Now, in our modern usage, those two words have been separated. But originally, as I understand it, mind meant the ability to discern the spirit. It has become now the ability to manipulate data. And Jung goes back to that unitary understanding of mind, and we're seeing him now go back to it. So his fascination with the sun would be his fascination with mind. Why? Because that's what he inherited from Freud. The only Geist that Freud acknowledged was the Geist of the mind. So naturally that's where he picks up. And in Freudian psychology, the whole goal is to get more mind,
so
more
we're
ego.
Talking about mind in the former sense?
Modern, okay. As consciousness, as intellect, okay. As rational function.
And that's why he has the emphasis on the sun right now.
Yeah, he's going back to this issue, okay, what is mind? And he first goes back to mind in the Freudian sense, in the modern Western sense. But pretty soon we're going to see that he realizes that understanding of mind is inadequate. And he will eventually then come to mind and spirit as being their really intrinsic unity. And I may have mentioned that's exactly what we talked about in that article that I think his grandson brought up at the display of the Red Book in Zurich. The reason Jung isn't accepted by universities is he challenges their definition of what mind is. And, you know, I've been taking this French for these years, and as much as I love it, they never can get to that other dimension. I'm going, now, maybe we'll talk about it today. You know, we read the play Waiting for Godot. Who wrote that? Ennui? Was it Ennui? Ennui? Jean Ennui? Well, whoever it is. You've heard the title, right? It's about these people sit around waiting for this guy, Godot. G-O-D. God? No. In our discussion, Godot was every person. We could never get in discussion, why would people be waiting for God? What is God? Because that intellect, that academic mind, has no place for the symbolic understanding. And I've had that experience like 50 times. We'll get so close to something, and then it's, okay, this equals this, and it's a rational category. So I think it's really relevant what Jung is going through, and it's you know, why his psychology has not been mainstream, because he disputes what mind is. Okay, so I say all that because he's back to the sun. Sun in Greek is helios. And it's pulled by white horses. And I don't know if this will help you or not, but I remember being in Santorini. I think you've been there, Sandy, right? Santorini is an island in the Aegean. And it's a volcanic island, so it's what's left of it is up high. And you're up high and you can see, you can't see the mainland of Greece, but you can see little islands dotting the Aegean. It's just gorgeous. And the sun is so bright and so yellow, being because you're closer to the equator, the huge changes, that it adds a beauty which is not really in the landscape itself. So there's sort of a fusion between the sun and the ocean, and it becomes alive in a way which really only a poet could describe. So I can see how the sun would be very closely associated with spirit almost. I mean, that sun in the Mediterranean has an enlivening power. So I can see how Jung is playing with it as almost spiritual. So he's very fascinated with the sun in that sense here, but we'll see pretty soon he realizes there's more to it. The sun and the spirit are related, but they're different aspects. So, it seems to me, I'm on the 1, 2, 3, 4 lines. It seems to me, third line, the end, it seems to me as if I had seen this white horse on the eastern sky over the rising sun. The horse spoke to me. What did it say? It said, "Hail him who is in darkness since the day is over him." There were 4 white horses, each with golden wings. They led the carriage of the sun on which Helios stood with flaring mane. 1,000 black serpents crawled swiftly into their holes. Right there, see how there's an A. Disharmony between the sun and the snake.
This is the sun that has no relationship to the snake.
To the snake. So the sun, you could almost say the snake would be the spirit mind and the sun the linear mind. Well, it doesn't hit him here. I'm just pointing that out. Helios ascended, rolling upward toward the white pass of the sky. Give us your light. Go down a couple of lines. Didn't Ammonius, remember Ammonius is the anchorite, say yesterday, "Do not forget to say your morning prayer when the sun rises." I thought that perhaps he secretly worships the sun. So, Christianity has become a religion of consciousness, he's realizing. See, the monk isn't worshiping God. The monk is worshiping clarity. Which, in a way, if you remember Ion, Jung felt was the great contribution of Christianity to Western civilization. The Catholic theologians took Aristotle and wed him to Christianity and sought to balance reason and faith, and in doing so emphasized the importance of reason. But what it's become is reason only. We get another hint in the next paragraph. Outside, a fresh morning wind rises. See, now the wind is the spirit. So the sun is an image of the mind, as of the spirit as mind. The wind is an image of the spirit as spirit, what we call spirit. All of this because, over the next page, of the reference to Logos. In the beginning was the Word, in John, top of page 271. And the word Logos in Greek is the same in German as Geist. And so when we read, in the beginning was the Word, that is a really paltry translation. It should be, in the beginning was the Logos. Logos being, on the one hand, mind, and on the other hand, spirit. The idea that there is an order running through life, which is divine. That order is what we see in dreams, as they evolve. It's the same thing. So you could say what Jung is doing is wrestling, what is Logos? He knows it's central, but he's gotten from Freud that it's intellect. He knows that's not incorrect, but he also is, I think, feeling there's got to be more to it. So now he's back thinking like a Freudian. The sun, what fills me with such inner exaltation. I should not forget my morning prayer, but where has my morning prayer gone? Dear son, I have no prayer, since I do not know how one must address you. So this thing that he was first excited about suddenly doesn't move him as much as it used to. And if you've ever been, you know, in a mess in your life and found yourself repeating the same crappy stuff again and again, same bad relationship, the same whatever it is, and you've been able to stop it through understanding, you can see how understanding damn near seems sacred. You realize, oh my God, I've been acting out my relationship to my dad, or I've been repeating my relationship with my mother. And when you realize that, you can stop it and live a fresh life that is not repeating the same old mistakes. That's where you see the sun as God, almost. Your consciousness makes such a difference in the quality of your life that it seems sacred. But all that does is stop the bad behavior. It doesn't have a way of finding what the true self is. For that, you need the mind as spirit. Does that make sense if I put it like that? And in practical work, you know, some people will come in and with a problem, and we work through it in this sense of replacing bad behavior with understanding, and they're happy. And they say, oh, done. And I say, fine. That's a completely satisfactory end. So they never really get to the spirit. It doesn't matter. Whatever life is holding is so enjoyable that they don't have to ask that question. So it is a very important principle, the sun as mind and spirit. And you can see how it's exalted. But Jung is looking for a deeper understanding. So he says Ammonius, a couple lines down, probably does not know we have no more prayers. So he's realizing he needs more than mind as consciousness. How should he know about our nakedness and poverty? Well, if the sun is so exalted, why are we naked and poor? Because we need a different and deeper, not different, but a deeper definition of spirit. What has happened to our prayers? Then he goes down a little farther, but why then do we not pray there in the city? I must look toward the sun as if it had something to do with it, you see, as if. Alas, one can never escape the age-old dreams of mankind. So the age-old dream would be the longing for the spirit. He's turning to the sun to solve it, but it doesn't. In other words, you could say the Freudian definition of healing is not adequate. The Freudian definition of spirit isn't adequate. The goal of Freudian psychology, remember the big phrase, you can always remember, in Freud is where id is, there let ego be. What is unconscious in you, you replace with consciousness. And that for Freud's the solution. So that's tantamount to saying that consciousness is the highest value. And Jung would say it is a very high value, but for some people, it's not just consciousness, but consciousness of the spirit that is the highest value. And that's what he is seeking, stumbling to find, I think, at this point. That make sense?
That takes me back symbolically to Santorini, where it is such an intense sun that you're under. It's like, it's a clarity, like you said, but you long for a nice little cool cave to go into, you know, something dark. And so that would take you symbolically to the next level, easy spirit, release the forms.
Let's see. Okay, so far. Now, we get the Beatle. Nothing to do with John Paul Ringo. So he's looking at the desert. Now, go down a little bit, about halfway to that paragraph that starts with what? Over there, a small, dark beetle is crawling along, pushing a ball in front of it. A scarab. We get a footnote, and I brought along some...
Is it? It's the color thing. It's off again.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I remember we had problems with...
There we go.
Giving it one.
Yeah. Right.
Color. And it just...
Maybe I should bring my own cable. That's better, huh?
Is that a little bit better?
Yeah. Why won't this thing? Well, folks, thanks. Tomorrow was a technology.
Yes. What are you trying to do?
I think the program is frozen.
You mean to show the footnote?
I wanted to show you a picture of a beetle.
Of a beetle.
But the computer's locked up.
Maybe it wants to hide.
Maybe. Our turtle is taking over. No, I'm going to show it now.
When in doubt, reboot.
When in doubt, reboot. Drop out. Who was it? Things that we ended up saying. Drop out. Turn on and boot up. Well, I'll try to talk while this is booting up. The beetle is a key image in Egyptian mythology. And I think the beetle that they're talking about is pretty close to what we call a Japanese beetle. It's that kind of a beetle. Remember that synchronicity where Jung said that the beetle was tapping on the window? Remember that? The memories? No? Mm-hmm. One of the examples he gave of a synchronicity was he was part of the problem is I got so many slides on here, I may have to break this program up. That it overloads my Teamsy little computer. See how long it takes to pull it up. A woman had a dream of a scarab beetle. And Jung said she was very rational. And this is, he tells us in Memories. And he couldn't get anywhere with her. Everything he said she would respond to, you know, logically, I can't be right logically. And she had a dream of this scarab beetle, which is an Egyptian image. And he heard a tap, tap, tap on the window. And it was a Japanese beetle tapping on the window. And he opened the window, and the beetle flew in and landed on his hand. And he said, here's your scarab. And it so shocked her that it broke through her rational mind. So it's a really important image in Egyptian mythology. And the characteristic of the Egyptian version is it will find some cow dung and lay its egg in the dung, form that into a little ball, and push the ball to a safe place. So it lays its egg in cow manure. Well, the Egyptians didn't understand eggs and things like that. So what they saw was a beetle pushing dung, and then out of that dung came a baby beetle. So in Egyptian mythology, it had to do with rebirth through darkness. That's the whole point of all this talk. And I brought along some slides, some Egyptian slides. And furthermore, it was thought to be an image of the sun. Remember, we're dealing with the symbolic mind. Get it up here. Hopefully it'll work. If not, see how the sun has a beetle head? That's the sun going across the ocean, and it will come up and rise in the morning. And so the head of the sun in some depictions was a beetle. You know, I say that because in case this doesn't work, you at least have seen it once.
So that winged disc in our historiated initial is the sun god.
Yeah, well, I should have gone back. Let's go back to do that in a second. But okay. Just see here the beetle. Mm-hmm. And so the two images of the sun are the beetle and the eye. So what you see what was occurred to Jung now, and really out straight out the cleft of his unconscious, he's seen the sun, and then he gets this image in his fantasy of a beetle, which is transformation through the shit. So he's gone from the clarity of the sun to rebirth through darkness.
And in Egypt, that winged disc, that sun god, transforms into a scarab. It tells us that in the footnote, right?
Well, let's see.
Footnote 61.
I guess, yeah. So here he is transformed.
Yeah.
Remember, the Egyptian idea was that the sun rose, then it set, and when they thought the sun was a person, and when it set, it got into a boat, and then that boat went across the ocean of the underworld because they didn't know the world was round. They thought it set into the ocean, and then it traveled across the ocean in a boat. And when morning was when that boat got to the other side, and the sun continued its journey. So that half the journey was in the underworld in the ocean.
And that scarab's role was to was the transformation. The dead sun god transforms into
right.
The scarab.
Right.
It's the scarab that can make the new sun or the rejuvenated sun occur.
Right. Right. But you see how suddenly he's gone from Helios as this constant exalted bright light to a sun that dies and is reborn. You don't have death and rebirth in Greece of the sun. You have Helios maybe going with his chariot under the earth, but he's never thought to transform through the darkness like the Egyptian sun is. And you're right, God, we should have gone back. Okay, it's working. And looked at the historiated initial. See, there's the beetle.
And this image of the sun and the beetle together is present way back in the beginning when Jung is in the cave and he's killed the hero, and then you get both the scarab and the sun.
Was the scarab in that picture? Itself was in that picture?
I'm almost certain that it was. It's pretty far back.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
What did you say about it, Kathy?
Well, here we get the sun together with the beetle in the underworld, and the snakes that in this image, you know, that we just read about the sun, go into the earth. Here they are with the sun, whereas in the above world, they're not significant.
Right, that's what I meant when I said this, the snakes fled through the helios.
Mm-hmm. But here they are drawn to it. And then there's the scarab. So.
Good point. Mm-hmm. So, see, we're getting two images of the mind, helios and the scarab. Mm-hmm. Or Helios and the, or you could say the Greek understanding of sun and the Egyptian understanding of sun. The Egyptian understanding of sun brings with it a relationship to darkness. And because it can go down and die, that's when you hear the spirit. Spirit is what speaks to you when your Helios mind has been discombobulated.
And if you think about how many rituals they had around death and how much they really valued death just as much as life.
Right.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yes, indeed.
To go back that far.
So that's the historical background of it, and then the psychological meaning of that is he's playing with two understandings of life. Because the mind as what can apprehend spirit is going to be the foundation of our method.
I was wondering if, I don't know what station means, but they talk about the guy transforms himself at the 10th station.
I don't either, Jane.
And, okay.
But apparently it goes through different steps in the underworld.
Yeah, if you read the book, if you look at the Book of the Dead, is it the Book of the Dead?
Probably.
Egyptian Book of the Dead, they have, if there's a whole process that the soul goes through. I don't know that much about it, but just I knew that much, that there are steps that they take.
Yeah.
And this is probably the 10th or 12th station, whatever it is, 12th station.
Well, you know, what's so hard for us to remember is, you know, we assume the sun is, we know the sun's going to rise every day. They didn't. So they thought, if we don't do something right, it won't rise. And so hence the elaborate rituals around making sure that the proper steps are followed in religious worship so that the sun will rise. Remember that that mountain lake said to Jung that we make the sun rise, and if the whites don't shape up, we're going to stop? That's the primal mind.
And that's something that you learn in yoga practice. That's the first thing you do, is the sun salute in the morning. Face east and do the sun salute. So you're doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it just really brings to mind, too, that if we don't treat nature, I mean, you know, when an atom bomb goes off, everything's dark. But the sun wouldn't.
Yeah, if you take what that Native American says symbolically, suddenly it's not so stupid. Now, if we don't understand the symbolic way of living and not overrun it with our power, the power of our technology, we could create a situation. There's no world left.
But
talking about this reminds me psychologically of where I was even as a kid. Like, if I don't take care of my mother, the world's going to disappear. I mean, it feels like that.
So he's going from Helios to the scarab in this quest for a deeper understanding of understanding, you might say. So all that, do we want to say anything more about the pain?
I just found this one reference to the priest and more in this book about the psychology. There is also a tree with roots on top and the bottom. Here it is emphasized that one gets to roots wherever one goes. This is what someone dreams, who wishes, or hopes for too much. He is being told, everything around you is earth, and with the earth you are supposed to form a union. Conversely, the tree can have crowns on top and bottom. This tree kind of does as well. Here, everything is leaf and blossom and fruit, heaven above, heaven below. Also, when the development apparently leads downward, the tree will still bear blossoms and fruit. I can substantiate this for each of the cases.
What page is that?
Now, what was the beginning idea of that, Anne?
There's also a tree with roots on the top and the bottom, and he's answering questions about Dr. Howard, who was somebody from India, was talking about yoga, and then he was answering the questions for his group.
So who was saying that?
A young one.
Is that in this essay on Kundalini Yoga?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so this is actually in the appendix, and this is when he is answering questions after Dr. Howard's journey.
I see.
And what is his point of... What is the point he's making? I didn't quite get it. The significance of it?
It referenced a tree with roots on the top and the bottom. And it said that that one gets to roots wherever one goes. So I thought...
Well, that does go with our motif, because we're talking about logos coming up or logos coming down.
Yeah.
So that does reflect that motif very well.
And he talks about what a symbol means is entirely dependent on the particular state of consciousness of the individual. So
and that reflects the same. Yeah. That reflects that motif too.
So I thought it was interesting that on the left, you know, the scarab is very large, and it's pushing its little ball of dung up there.
Yeah, there you see it.
Mm-hmm. And the crucifix is gold, and the snake is, I guess, blue, and it's smaller than, say, the crucifix and the snake, or at least the snake on the right, that is now golden, is now larger, and the scarab is smaller. So it seemed to me intuitively something about that scarab has entered the snake and made it larger.
Mm.
That's just...
Yeah, good point. Hey, is this a mamba? This is a mamba.
Yes.
This is
awesome. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's over there in the red, too.
Mm-hmm. And now the dung is in the sun image that has come to earth.
Where's
that? On the right,
yeah.
In the disc.
I don't know if that's the swastika or not. I don't
know. It's significant that our logos image has now combined the earth image within itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the point, I think.
Mm-hmm. And here's his father.
Great, and then there's the going down again. And that creates that tree.
Uh-huh, yeah, right.
And all that enlarges the idea of sun.
Mm-hmm. And I think Carol pointed out last time how different the images in the background are on the right than they are on the left.
Also above and below. Mm-hmm. You have all sorts of figuration down below.
Mm-hmm. Human, yeah. Uh-huh. And animal form.
And then Anne reminded us that the only actual earthly form in the blue above is like a skeleton of a fish.
Mm-hmm.
Like the passing age of Annika Pisces.
Where is that? I know you pointed out last time that you wanted to go
to the laser
corner. That's that one right
there. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And what's the image of the, in the earth, if you will, in the bottom? It's like...
Here.
I don't know if anybody's seen it. Mm-hmm.
The top button.
Oh, sorry. The image here. Is that a scarab?
It seems like it.
Okay.
A scarab?
Yeah.
Or a beetle.
Scarab, although it's got eight legs.
What? Where do you see eight legs?
Well, it's side on, so you've got the four, so you know there's another four on the other side.
But show me in the outline. I don't even...
It's mouth.
Well, bug head, bug body.
Oh, I see.
Two, three, four legs.
Oh, see, I didn't see those
halfway
bit. Yes, I saw them as mouth.
I don't think that a scarab has much of a mandible. I was going to say, I wonder if it'll compete anybody with a leg inside.
Is it coming off the head first?
Yeah, true.
Maybe it's getting a big mouth.
But then the figure has a sort of, it has its dagger of, discernment out there, like a shield. And then there's just a beast here.
There's another human.
And here's the sword and the character.
But his beetles only have six legs.
I know. But
they do have the two coming off.
It's abstracted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I meant the blue ones.
Yeah.
How many legs do a beetle have?
Six.
Oh, I thought you said eight. Sorry. Okay.
It does have. Well, this appears to have eight, is what I was saying.
Oh.
Because you're one, two, three, four on this side, and then it would have four on the other side.
Oh. But we're debating whether this.
Mm-hmm. Push the side arrow. Oops. Push it again. Try it again. Whoops. You're pushing the wrong arrow.
All right. I'll push the other one.
Yeah.
Okay. So, we're just trying to decide if that's perhaps a mandible, but anyway, it just seems like it has to be a fair, just because of the appearance.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody think that was very good? The main tree in this is what we call the tree we have here, deciduous.
Mm-hmm.
They go through the four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
And change.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on the bottom there's five palm trees over here and four over here. Mm-hmm. And palm trees don't, of the desert, they stay the same.
I guess he's just showing us even in Egypt with the scale of them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, you get the idea. Good work. I just really wanted to stress and how that beetle plays such a role in Egyptian myth. And if you look at Egyptian pictures, you'll see it all over the place.
Well, and then the American Indian myth, the sun can't rise again without the help of the mother and the guidance of the mother. And so he's bringing in the not only darkness, but feminine aspect that allows the growth and the rebirth. It's not going to happen without it.
and maybe just because Elizabeth Taylor died this week, but when I looked at that image, I just saw her with that black hair and that
Cleopatra.
It was just like, oh my God, there she is.
She made such a good one.
She did. She did. Probably a better one than Cleopatra.
So let's see. You dear little animal, are you still toiling away under, toiling away in order to live your beautiful myth? About halfway down the paragraph, it starts with, what shall I? He says, over there, a small dark beetle is crawling along, pushing a ball. That would be the ball of dung with its eggs in it. In front of it, a scarab. You dear little animal, are you still toiling away in order to live your beautiful myth? Now, the last line of that paragraph, we men have given up playing at mythology. So, he's getting a new grasp of the mind now. A little farther down, four lines down in the next paragraph, I still haven't really understood what he actually means. That's the acrine. So he's saying, I think what he's really saying is, because it doesn't mean anything to me anymore.
Do you think? But Jung went on to find a lot of wisdom in the sayings of the Bible that weren't...
Yeah, but no, I don't think he's talking about Christianity. He's talking about the rationalizing tendency within Christianity. That, you know, he's saying, well, everyone else seems to be fed by it, but I don't get it. It doesn't feed me anymore. And I think the fact is, it either does or it doesn't. I mean, I marvel at how people can be fed by that stuff. They may experience something I don't. And it's just, they do and I don't. I don't think we can make any judgments. And I think Jung is saying here, I don't. I was even very thankful to him. that he wanted to teach me. But I'm being critical again and superior and may well learn nothing. His thoughts are not that bad at all. They are even good. I don't know why I always want to put the man down.
But he did take something important, which was the coming up of the Logos. He got that from Ammonius.
Yeah. I say he got it from Freud. But,
well, he just states it as thus in the text.
But he's seeing the historical background of where that way of looking at things came from.
Well, I'm speaking symbolically, you know, about what he took from such encounters with those ideas.
Right. The importance of consciousness. And the importance of Christian values that support consciousness. Grace, kindness, tenderness, responsibility, devotion, all those are values that support consciousness. And I think, you know, drunkenness, irresponsibility, self-seeking, that does not support consciousness. And for a long time, the acquisition of consciousness was the most important goal of our civilization, Jung will say in Ion. But he's now expanding his view.
Well, I take it as, you know, his famous saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
I mean, he's not trying to devalue that or to throw it all out. He's just trying to add to it.
Yeah, he's going for either and or. But I think a little bit here critical of his first understanding, because he realizes something needs to be added to it.
Right, added to it, not throw it all the way
right.
out.
Right, yeah, right. Dear Beetle, where have you gone? Then, dear Scarab, the italicized, my father, I honor you, blessed be your work in eternity. What nonsense am I talking? So, at this point, the new seems ridiculous to it. Let's take a stretch.